This is KBOO's The Voice of the Middle East. صوت الشرق الأوسط من إذاعة كيبو و صدای خبرمیانه از رادیو KBOO.
طلق بابنا طلونا السبيا بين ربوعنا خلونا حكم زهرات الوالي وطلق بابنا
Welcome to another installment of Voices of the Middle East on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Gudarz Ektedar, your host. For tonight's show, considering the changes that are happening kind of daily in the Middle East, and specifically the negotiation about the nuclear issue with Iran, and the announcement this week of Secretary Rice that the United States will join the negotiation if Iran abandon the enrichment program. It's a pleasure to have Professor Eran Avrahamyan, who is a distinguished professor in the Department of History, Barak College, and the Graduate Center in the City University of New York. Dr. Avrahamyan has written a number of books on modern Iran, including Iran Between Two Revolutions, The Iranian Mujahideen, Khomeinism, Tortured Confessions, and most recently, Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Co-authored with Bruce Cummings and Moshe Moaz. Welcome to the show, Professor Avrahamyan.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Doctor. Let me start with, maybe you can give a brief for the listeners on the history of U.S.-Iran relation before the Islamic Revolution, and maybe the first two decades of the Islamic Revolution. How do you characterize this political relation between the U.S. and Iran?
Well, it's been back and forth. Obviously, before the revolution, the relations between the U.S. government and the Shah were very good, but the relations between the U.S. government and the Iranian people were not so good. And then after the revolution, things changed because especially with the hostage crisis, the Iranian regime blamed United States for the dictatorship that had existed under the Shah. And United States, of course, then blamed the Iranian government for the hostage crisis. So since really 1979, 1980, relations have been very strained. There have been some periods, especially under the President Clinton, and President Khatami, there were relations somewhat improved, but were not normalized. And in more recent years, the main issue has been, of course, the nuclear issue. And at the moment, actually, the crisis obviously is on the U.S. feared that Iran is intending to develop a nuclear bomb, while Iran insists that its nuclear program is a civilian program, not a weapons program. And that's where the nitty-gritty comes down to now.
Could you also give us a little, maybe an introduction to what kind of, I mean, if there has been any signs from each side or conditions set forth for resumption of the relation between two countries, I mean, the official relations in the past. And you mentioned during the President Khatami and President Clinton, there were some kind of gestures, at least from Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, and how these things played, and how come it didn't work?
It was actually mostly bad timing. There was a period when Khatami, when he came in, he almost came very close to basically apologizing for the hostage crisis. But at that time, the leader in Iran, the supreme leader, was not that that keen on normalizing relations, so I think he put a brake on improvement of relations. Then there was a period when President Clinton almost came close to apologizing for the 1953 coup, but then there was pressure from Congress, and in fact sanctions from Congress were tightened up, and that actually hurt Iran-U.S. Trade. So that was scuttled. And since 2000, since President Bush came into office, the relations have fast deteriorated, mainly because the group of people in the administration that are usually called the neoconservatives were being very bellicose about Iran. They've made no secret that their desire is basically regime change, the overthrow of the Islamic Republic, and that obviously hasn't helped in improving relations.
You have made a comment recently that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's statement about America's willingness to talk to Iran has an important modification in U.S. position. Could you a little explain what kind of change do you see as far as U.S.'s gesture?
Yes, there are two major changes in U.S. policy in the last week. One is that it's U.S. is willing to actually negotiate with Iran. Until now, the U.S. has not been, under the Bush administration, has not been willing to negotiate. So that was seen as a major change. But hidden away in Rice's statement was, I think, an equally important change, that she said United States was willing to accept Iran having a civilian nuclear program. And this was new, too, because in the last 4 years, the administration's been adamant that U.S. cannot tolerate Iran having any nuclear program, even if it's avowedly peaceful purposes, because it's too dangerous. It could develop into a weapons program. So there's two important changes, but I think we don't yet know what is in the actual proposal U.S. has sent to Iran. We'll know in the next week, but as the old saying goes, the devil's in the details. It could be that there will be serious proposals, in which case I think the problem could be resolved. But if in the fine print there are a lot of American conditions that are would be unacceptable for Iran, then obviously it will be a non-starter. The concern would be, for instance, if the United States said, well, Iran can have a civilian nuclear program, but not now, in future, or it could have it only on conditions that we are 100% sure it's only for civilian purposes. If a lot of conditions are put on Iran, I don't think the Iranian regime is going to go along with it. So in which case, the negotiations would quickly break down. But hopefully there won't be such stringent conditions put in that letter.
I'm sure you're aware that at some point in the past, Iranian negotiators have asked for some sort of guarantee, a security guarantee, and at least taking off the military option off the table when they were negotiating with Europeans, and apparently Europeans could not make that kind of commitment. But last week, probably 2 weeks ago, when Secretary Rice was interviewed on one of these network channels, she kind of took that position and the question that was put on the table, whether she's willing to make a guarantee that there wouldn't be any military option against Iran. She said, well, if this is a kind of a peaceful program, why would that matter at all? What is your opinion on that kind of statement?
Well, they're obviously intentionally trying to be somewhat ambiguous because they want to frighten Iran with the possibility that if Iran doesn't basically come forth, U.S. does have the option of using military force. But at the same time, they don't want to talk too much about military force because that would actually alienate the Europeans. The British have especially been saying that military force really is not in the thinking. There's also the practical problems that Iran knows that United States at the moment is not in a position to really use military force because of the problems in Iraq. But obviously they don't want to remove it completely from the table because some people in Washington feel that military force should be always at least a threat to use against Iran. And this, of course, doesn't help the negotiations because if there is any talk of military force, it helps the diehards in Iran. And there, I think the equivalents to the neoconservatives there who really don't want a resolution to this because they feel Iran is in a good position to actually do whatever it wants without fear of United States. So it becomes a very complicated relations. It's not just between U.S. and Iran, but it's very between different tendencies in Washington and in Tehran too.
Let me ask you, what is your analysis of what is going to happen next? I mean, what is your forecast?
Well, to be optimistic, I think the problem could be resolved because U.S. interest is Iran not getting the bomb. And Iran's interest is, it's always made it clear that they don't want the bomb, they want nuclear program, especially enrichment program for peaceful purposes. Now, since the U.S. has now moved to the position that it's willing to accept a civilian program, which could include an enrichment program, then there's no reason not to be optimistic. Unless there are these sort of fine points in the proposal that would make it too much of an obstacle, such as the enrichment can take place, let's say, 10 years from now, but for 10 years, you know, Iran has to basically freeze its program. That I don't think will be acceptable to them. But on the other hand, Iran would have to give United States guarantees through inspections that the enrichment program they would have would not be on such a large scale, what's called industrial scale, to produce a bomb. And that should assure, obviously, United States that Iran is not interested in a bomb. But these are actually proposals that United Nations has suggested in the past of permitting Iran having an enrichment program, but an enrichment program that would be not on a scale enough to be able to make produce bombs. Hopefully that's the route the U.S. will go. But I think if there are very stringent rule set, such as Iran couldn't in theory have enrichment but not in practice, that just is not going to fly in Tehran. Especially at this present mood and the feeling of confidence because of Iraq, I think the Iranian government will walk out of the negotiations. And even if it alienates the Europeans, they would go ahead with the enrichment program. in which case there will be a major, I think, crisis between U.S. and Iran.
The Iranian party had suggested or proposed an international consortium to work on uranium enrichment on an industrial level or scale, as you refer to. Do you think any possibility for something like that to materialize?
Well, it depends where it was. The American the European proposal was actually, I think the Russians suggested first, would be that it would be done outside Iran, which I don't think is would be in Iran's interest. I don't think they would accept that. Iran would be willing to have it in Iran, but it could be international, i.e. it could be Western companies jointly doing it with Iran. But again, if it's in Iran on a large scale, that would not be acceptable for United States. So what it boils down to is where is the enrichment taking place? If it's going to be in Iran, that would be okay for Iran, but it wouldn't be good for United States. If it's done outside Iran, that would be might be acceptable for the Europeans and Russia, but it wouldn't be acceptable for Iran. At least that's my understanding of it.
Okay. Setting aside the political issue of the nuclear program in Iran, do you see really an economic justification for all the, I guess, cost that is being spend on this, not only by paying third parties to purchase equipment, but also creating a chaos that at any time could have even cost hundreds of thousands of people's life in the country. What is the real, engine behind this commitment by Iranian government? They turned that issue into a national a pride concept. They try to talk about it as a similar situation with the nationalization of oil back in 1950s, and Dr. Mossadegh attempt on that. And what is your opinion on this issue, and why is Islamic Republic is pushing it thus far?
Well, I think they make an economic argument, and there is some justification for the economic argument in that Iran does need other alternate sources of energy besides petroleum and gas. It is actually investing quite a lot in hydroelectric as an alternative, but as even the fear existed in the 1970s that sooner or later the oil and gas are going to run out. So Iran does need other sources of energy. So there is some justification for nuclear as an alternative. And the expenses are not that actually huge. Building nowadays refineries is quite expensive too. That's one reason very few countries have built oil refineries in the last 20 years. But I think beyond the economics, I think the real issue is, I think what you touched on, it's a question of national prestige. National honor, or the idea now being that to be on the cutting edge of modern science, to be basically an industrial society in the 21st century, you need to have nuclear technology, the scientists, the expertise. And it's one way of sort of leapfrogging into the modern world. The old view would be sort of the nuclear club. And I think Iran does have that aspirations. It's a sort of prestige aspirations that it being nuclear, but not being military nuclear, but scientifically nuclear, would basically give it what it deserves to be an important country in the world, maybe not on par with Japan or Europe, but at least it's no longer a third world underdeveloped country. So that has become part of the national aspirations, I would say. And I think it also resonates in the public, and this is an area in which the regime does have actually public support.
I would like to kind of move a little bit and change gear now that we have you in hand. And I know that you are one of the authorities basically on Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization. You wrote your book, 10, 15 years ago, I believe. And it's still one of the rare documentation on that organization. And the name of the organization came out several times recently as a potential group that could be used, especially being favored by some of the forces in Defense Department and also in the U.S. Congress. What state are these organizations at this time? Do you follow their path recently? Have you done that?
Well, only in what gets published. I haven't tried to go to Iraq to interview Mujahideen people at their camp or anything. But what information filters through here is that obviously the U.S. Surrounded the main base they had in Iraq. They're probably about 5,000 to 6,000 Mujahideen there, and the administration was very much divided on what to do with the Mujahideen. There were some, you know, especially neoconservatives, who felt they could use them against Iran for infiltration, for spying, maybe even for sabotage, but there were others such as the State Department who had already actually categorized the Mujahideen as a terrorist organization, and obviously they couldn't do that, even legally, they couldn't do it by American law. So there was this, I would say, division within the Washington about how to deal with them. The way they've resolved that is not to openly support the Mujahideen, but take volunteers from members of the Mujahideen who are willing to leave the Mujahideen and come out and then work for the Pentagon, either in terms of giving information or, I suspect by now, infiltrating into Iran for gathering information or even for sabotage. So there are individuals, members of the Mujahideen, who are being used now as a part of destabilization of the regime. But I think the people who want to have regime change in Washington, if the negotiations don't succeed, they seem to be more now relying on ethnic organizations, not so much on the Mujahideen, but small organizations that have suddenly cropped up in the last year that claim to represent this or that minority group in Iran. So this actually is a historic change in American-Iranian relations, and ever since U.S. has had relations with Iran going back to early 20th century, U.S. has always been in support of the national integrity of the Iranian state. But in the last 2 years, there's been what Washington says is using the ethnic card, i.e. Encouraging various ethnic groups to talk about federalism, about being oppressed, about basically challenging the Tehran government. And this is, in fact, very dangerous for Iran, but for the Middle East, too, because the logic of that is trying to turn Iran into what Iraq has become in the last 2 years since the invasion, a complete ethnic nightmare.
In the same line, I guess, in the past few weeks, there has been some unrest in Azerbaijan and the rest of the country by Azerbaijani people. And do you see any relation between these efforts in Washington and what is happening there, or do you have any other suggestion for justification of these acts?
Well, I think it's not just Azerbaijan. There, in the last few months, there have been quite a lot of violence, kidnappings, bombings in Balochistan, in Khuzestan, in the Kurdish areas, and in the demonstrations in Azerbaijan. In all those areas, there are obviously some grievances, but as the old saying goes, it's no accident. Suddenly, these grievances have taken shape in form of violence, and the fact that this has all come at a time when U.S. has, or some people in the U.S. government have been talking about using the ethnic card. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to say there's a connection between the two.
I assume that you also yourself belong to a religious minority in Iran?
Yes, I'm an Armenian, yes.
What is your personal experience as far as discrimination against the minorities and ethnic groups in Iran?
I wouldn't call it discrimination. The various, each ethnic group has had a different history, and the religious minorities that are legally recognized, which would be in the Christians, Armenians, Assyrians, also the Zoroastrians and the Jewish, have a legal status in which they have representation in parliament. They have their own councils. They actually have their own religious laws they can practice. So there is no, I would say, no religious persecution in that way. Obviously, in terms of jobs, especially state jobs, people from the minorities are at a disadvantage in trying to get through this into high positions in state ministries or departments. So there's a, so you could say, unofficial bias there, but in terms of a status, it's not persecution. The problem, then the issues of the linguistic minorities is different. Linguistic minorities such as Kurds, Baluchis, Arabs, Azerbaijanis. There again, the state is much more in favor of Persian because Persian is the state language, the educational language. But on the whole, actually, those linguistic minorities are far better treated now than they were under the Pahlavi monarchy. In fact, the languages can be used for publications, for local use. And I wouldn't say there is a strong tension between the linguistic minorities and the Iranian state. In the Kurdish areas, it's somewhat complicated now by the fact that there is a de facto Kurdish independence in North Iraq, and this could overflow for aspirations of Kurds in Iran to have also independence. But I don't think that's a major problem because the Kurds in Iraq can, in fact, use their pressure on Kurds in Iran not to be too vociferous, because the Kurds in Iraq very much depend on Iran for basically survival, because there's always the fear that Turkey might invade. And if that happens, the Kurds in Iraq would very much depend on Iran as their protectors, and basically in the past also they've really kept good relations with Iran. So the president of Iraq, for instance, Talabani, he spends going back and forth to Tehran because he wants to keep as good relations as he can with Iran. You could at first sight say, you know, Iran really has a serious problem with the Kurds. But I think in practical terms, that problem can be controlled because of the situation in Iraq. There's another minority that I think has the most serious problems, which is the Baha'i minority, because they're a religious minority, but they're not accepted as a legitimate minority. So the persecution that has occurred since the revolution has been really directed at the Baha'is. And that's a situation, of course, it was worst in the 1980s. Under the Khatami administration, it improved. And time will show whether things will continue to improve or maybe even get worse as far as the Baha'is are concerned. There it's really a theological problem, because for the Shi'i clerics, Baha'ism is a form of apostasy, and they have trouble with dealing with that.
One last question. Again, your book, Torture Confessions, touched on many aspects of human rights violations in Iran, and specifically you dedicated a whole chapter to the I would call it the massacre that happened in 1986 and 87 in prisons. Do you think that in any way or shape these negotiations could be somehow linked with a human rights situation in Iran, as being also suggested by Dr. Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel laureate?
I don't think it's useful to bring issues of human rights when states are dealing really with state issues. Here, the state issues being the nuclear issue, or the U.S. interest or not interest in regime change. I think once you bring in issue of human rights, however important it is an issue, it really muddies the problem. And there are a lot of countries, of course, violate human rights. And I'm not sure United States, especially now, is in a position to lecture other countries on a violation of human rights and even the question of democracy. I think it just makes us in the United States look hypocritical if we start talking about other countries have to abide by the Geneva Convention, since people in the White House consider Geneva Convention somewhat of a quaint old document. That's the phrase they use, the quaint document. So if United States considers human rights and a quaint document, then someone like the president of Iran can basically say, well, we also consider it a quaint document. We don't have to at least answer to United States whether we are abiding with it or not. I think human rights is much better left to people who focus on that, such as Amnesty or Human Rights Watch or NGOs. But once governments get involved in it, it just really makes politics much more complicated. Well, it makes the politics much more heated, and you're not going to get resolutions on important issues such as the nuclear issue.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Abrahamian. It was a great pleasure, and I hope we can get you on the show in the future as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I would like to actually air this speech of Dr. Shirin Ebadi, the Iranian Women Nobel Laureate of 2003, who spoke on May 19 in Tehran, I'm sorry, in Portland, an invitation of World Affairs Council of Oregon, and we'll listen to that piece.
At the outset, I'd like to extend my gratitude to those individuals who have supported the establishment of the Persian Study Center at Portland State. We live in the era of globalization, where boundaries have become meaningless, and what matters and is defined most within countries is actually their culture. If we cannot retain our culture and our language, we will be destroyed. Iran exists not only within the geographic boundaries that it occupies, but also within the hearts and minds of all Iranians.
ایران با فرهنگ خود، با حفظ شاعر و آداب ملی خودش، با زبان ادبیات، با موسیقی نقاشی، با هنر زنده میمونه و بس.
Iranians are alive through their culture, civilization, language, history, belief, traditions, and literature and arts.
و برای ماست که این فرهنگی که سینه به سینه به ما رسیده به نسل آینده منتقل کنیم.
It is our responsibility to carry the culture that we have received from the previous generation to future generations.
بهترین جای حفظ این فرهنگ دانشگاه هاست و به همین دلیله که من سپاسگزارم که رشته ایران صداسی رو تأسیس کردیم.
The best place to retain this culture is within universities, and it is for this reason that I am especially grateful for the establishment of the Persian Study Center. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to begin with a primary question. Is democracy and human rights compatible with Islam or not? Those who seek to hold up their interests through war claim that concepts such as human rights, democracy, and modernity are by nature Western and therefore incompatible with Eastern culture, and especially the Islamic civilization. They claim that a clash between Western civilization and Islamic civilization is inevitable. And as proof, they refer to the acts of terrorism carried out by a number of individuals or groups, and also to the undemocratic nature of certain governments within the Muslim world. What is interesting is that a number of Muslims, too, believe in the same thing. On their part, they claim that the source of law must be divine, and in their minds, Islam is what they define, to the exclusion of the other interpretations and beliefs held by other Muslims. They view the world through the eyes of their predecessors, their forefathers, and try to equip themselves with their minds in understanding the needs of this time and age. They do not bestow legislative power to the elective members of society, such as members of the parliament. They believe that the most important responsibility of a parliament is to identify divine law and legislate accordingly. In short, the unfavorable situation in many Islamic countries regarding democracy and its status results from this mindset and the belief that democracy and human rights are incompatible with Islam. In these countries, Islam is only what is stated by the government. Whoever who opposes the government politically is labeled as a heretic and as an enemy. With this tool in their hands, undemocratic Islamic countries have been able to suppress political dissidents. They are also able to take the courage to fight from the people, for in the end, it is much easier to fight earthly governments rather than those who claim to uphold religion. Religion still remains dear. Yet, Islamic thinkers, enlightened Islamic thinkers, have been able to challenge this mode of thinking among many Islamic governments. Through religion itself, they are able to claim that not every action of the government, although claimed to be religious, is in fact not necessarily religious and Islamic. They maintain that Islam is compatible with democracy and human rights. The number of these thinkers is increasing across the Muslim world. Like any other religion, Islam has many different interpretations. In the West, one church endorses the marriage of homosexuals, whereas one may refute it, and they too belong to the Christian church and establishment. It's the same with Islam. It can have various interpretations. In a country such as Saudi Arabia, women do not have the right to drive, let alone participate in social and political life. In a country such as Kuwait, it is only in this current year, 2006, that women have gained the right to vote. Yet in other countries such as Indonesia or Malaysia, or even Pakistan and Bangladesh, women leaders have emerged from many years ago as prime ministers and presidents. Some Islamic countries such as Indonesia and Malaysia enjoy more progressive democracies. Yet others such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates are still in the embryonic stages of democratic process. Therefore, in fact, the main issue does not lie within Islam. Rather, for various reasons, some Islamic countries are not open to offering or accepting an interpretation of Islam that allows the religion to be compatible with democracy and human rights values. This is where the main problem lies. Muslims must learn that any act by the government, although in the name of religion, is not necessarily Islamic. Muslims must become aware that the key to heaven does not rest in the hands of Islamic governments. It is only then that genuine Islamic movements will emerge and replace acts of violence and terrorism. In addition to reactionary and fundamentalist governments, there are yet another group that have challenged this progressive thinking about religion. These are individuals, groups, people who label acts of violence by individual or groups who are Muslim as Islamic and therefore try to label religion as such. That is how they can justify the theory of the clash of civilizations and the wars that are waged in the Middle East. In fact, a dynamic Islam, an Islam that accepts democracy, one that respects cultural pluralism, is under attack from two sides. On one hand, Islamic fundamentalist groups who justify their wrongful acts through religion under the pretext of religion, and on the other hand, those who oppose Islam, those who try to use religion and Islam as a pretext for opposing the Muslim world and for justifying the wars that they wage. This is what the ignorant friends and the enemies of Islam who are aware of how to create enmity share in common. It is incumbent upon all enlightened Muslims to seize this historical juncture to show to the world the genuine face of Islam, one that abhors terrorism and acts of violence. For years, Muslims, Jews, and Christians have coexisted in the Middle East. In East Asia, Muslims have coexisted with followers of other beliefs and religions such as Buddhists, Hindus, and Confucianists. Truly, it is possible to live with followers of other beliefs and thoughts and to respect diverse opinions. Different cultures can identify their commonalities and based on that, create laws that will help all live peacefully together and progress. Democracy and human rights are required and needed by all cultures and all human societies. In any religion, respect for human life, property, and dignity is of the utmost importance. Terror, violence, torture, and the belittlement of any individual is abhorred by any religion and faith. Those who, under the pretext of cultural relativism, seek to violate human rights, either in the name of religious rights or in the name of national rights, are in fact simply fundamentalist reactionaries. The world will be at peace only when human rights values are universal. Unfortunately, in recent times, there has yet been a new excuse for violating human rights, and that is the pretext of fighting terrorism. Certainly, terror and violence is abhorrent under any religious or belief system, and it is necessary to fight and combat acts of terrorism. It is a legitimate right. Nonetheless, fighting terrorism must not become a pretext for suppressing the rights of individuals and silencing dissidents. Ladies and gentlemen, I come from Iran, and so I'd like to speak a bit about the human rights situation in my country. I begin by hoping that all political prisoners will be released in my country, especially Dr. Ramin Jahanbegloo, who was recently arrested. Following the Islamic Revolution, discriminatory laws against women were passed in Iran. I want to bring cite a few as examples. The value of the life of a woman is half that of a man. Therefore, if a woman gets into an accident or is hit by a car on the street, the damage paid to her would be half that paid to a man under similar circumstances. It takes two female witnesses before the court to substitute for one male witness. The law recognizes polygamy. A man can divorce his wife without any preconditions. It is very difficult and at times impossible, on the other hand, for a woman to seek divorce. Most interestingly, these laws are carried out in a society in which its women are more educated than its men. More than 65% of university students in Iran are females. Women in Iran gained the right to vote and even become parliamentary members many years ago, even prior to Switzerland. And women have been active in social life and in their careers, whether as university professors, as heads of organizations, and in other different professions, including members of parliament. I was once approached by a journalist who asked me how I would summarize in a phrase how Iran is. In response, I said, "Iran is a land of contradictions." I want to show you one such contradiction through an example. We've had members of parliament who are women from many years ago, and currently there are 13 women in parliament. Even Mr. Ahmadinejad, who represents the fundamentalist camp, has a woman vice president. But on the other hand, there is a law that stipulates that to leave the country, every woman would need the written permission of her husband first. Now imagine the female vice president wanting to participate in a UN meeting. The night before, she'd have to get her husband's written permission first. And God knows, if a fight breaks up between the two the night before, what happens to the Iranian seat at the UN? Through my memoirs, I was motivated to introduce Iran to the international community, our society, our land. As you can see, with these contradictions, you cannot view the reality of Iran through a single dimension. Many people who view Iranian law may believe that Iranian women do nothing except sit in their homes and cook all the time. But as I mentioned, Iranian women are more educated than Iranian men. So through my memoirs, it is my hope to be able to provide a glimpse of Iranian society to the reader. I've tried through the cases that I've talked about to reflect on the oppression against Iranian women and children under law. I want to cite another example of such laws. If a man kills a child, say the child of a neighbor, according to law, he will be punished through execution. But if he kills his own child, even intentionally, he will not be executed. He would receive a maximum 10 years in prison. What that means is that killing your own child is a case in which your sentence can actually be lessened. Although the Iranian government has adhered to the International Convention on the Rights of the Child, my brother-in-law, unfortunately, was killed in 1367 Iranian calendar year, approximately 17 years ago, along with a large number of other young people at the time. That's why I deemed it necessary to talk about them a bit in my book. I've also attempted to talk about, briefly, the history of Iran-U.S. relations in my book. I was 5 years old when I heard through the radio that our national hero, Prime Minister Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, was overthrown. I saw people very sad in the room. Some were crying, but I was a kid. I couldn't understand why. Later, I discovered that through a CIA coup, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, our national hero, was overthrown and spent the rest of his life under house arrest. Iranians have always been saddened through this, by this history. The negative consequences of that coup have remained in Iran to this day in the political and social arena. Living in Iran, I've witnessed an 8-year war between my country and Iraq. I recall days when Tehran was hit 15 or 16 times or perhaps more by Iraqi missiles on a single day. When we were told that missiles are about to hit the city, it felt like death was approaching all. Everyone was awaiting it through one place or another. Saddam destroyed 15 Iranian cities. He leveled them to the ground with bulldozers. In the war against Iran, Saddam used chemical weapons. He used chemical weapons not only against Iranian soldiers, but also against the Iraqi Kurds. Saddam was equipped with state-of-the-art weaponry. I remember that at the time, Saddam was a close friend of the United States, and you in this country and we in Iran have seen pictures of Mr. Rumsfeld shaking hands with him at the time. But I always try to remain impartial, and to do so, in my book, I've also talked about the mistakes taken by the Iranian government and the Iranian people. I'm speaking of the embarrassing mistake of the taking of American hostages in Iran. The act was not only a big political blunder, but it also brought about many negative consequences, politically speaking, for the country many years later. By talking about these relations, I've attempted not to speak of the history so much, but to insist that we forget history and think of the future of our relations. The Iranian people and the American people do not have any differences. It's their governments that have those differences. More than 2 million Iranians live in this country, in the United States. They're highly educated, very successful businessmen and businesswomen, and very good citizens. The American people have embraced them, in turn, with hospitality and with kindness. Governments have their differences, not people. So governments must solve those differences through negotiations. Negotiations that are open and direct. Do you know why I insist on having open negotiations? Because people have bad memories of closed-door negotiations. Let us recall the coup in 1953. Negotiations must therefore be open and direct at three levels: at a summit level, parliamentary level, and at the level of civil society and NGO groups. The people of Iran certainly have their own criticism of their government. I've touched on part of them. But despite the criticism, they strongly opposed a military attack by the United States on Iran or the threat of bombardment of our country. Iranians love their homeland and will not allow Iran to become another Iraq. Our problems will not be solved through a military attack. They can be resolved only by the hands of the Iranian people themselves. A military attack, or even the threat of a military attack, will retard the process towards democratization inside the country. For it will provide the government with an excuse to suppress freedom seekers and their rights under the pretext of national security. Democracy and human rights can only prevail under peaceful conditions. I wish peace for you, for Iranians, and for all the people of the world. I would like to end my remarks here. Thank you for being patient with me. I am happy to take any questions.
تاني يعني إن شاء الله تنذكر وما تنعاد بس لحتى ما ننسى
You were listening to Voices of the Middle East and I will just finish the program tonight and wish everybody a happy evening
جبها معليكي ليكي ليكي